Can't get enough true crime horror story? Check out our Patreon at www.patreon.com/truecrimehs for early access to ad-free episodes, exclusive bonus episodes, and patron-exclusive merchandise. For as little as $1 a month, you can support the show and help us bring you even more content. Thanks for listening, and let the night roar.
True Crime Horror Story contains extreme violence and adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I am your host, JD Horror, and this is True Crime Horror Story, Season 2, Episode 5, Sexual Sadists, Part 3. The following cases are extremely graphic and disturbing and deal with the murder of children. If you are sensitive to this subject, I would suggest skipping this episode of True Crime Horror Story. For those of you with a strong stomach, strap in and get your barf bag ready, because it's time to meet Andre Chikatilo. Part 1. The Rostov Ripper. During the early to mid-1930s, millions of Ukrainians were killed as part of the Holodomor, a deliberate and intentional man-made famine that was instituted by Stalin's Soviet government. A strict rationing system was implemented, and often, rations were outright denied. The punishment for the theft of even a handful of grain from the collective could be execution. The starvation was so rampant that cannibalism became a widespread practice during the Hungry Winter, with over 2,500 people later being convicted of the atrocious act, often parents consuming the flesh of their weaker offspring who would typically perish first. The thought of the gaunt and emaciated mother and father stripping the flesh of their child from its bones in order to sustain life for the surviving family members is living hell personified. These weren't your Albert Fishes or Jeffrey Dahmers, but sad, desperate people struggling to survive. Life in the USSR in this era was abysmal. It was under these conditions that on October 16, 1936, Andrei Romanovich Chikatilo was pushed out of his mother's womb into the cold and cruel world. Unfortunately for over 50 people, with the entrance and survival of young Andrei, the world would be exponentially more cruel, and the boy would grow up to be Russia's most notorious serial killer of all time. Chikatilo was born with lesions and water on his infant brain. Often the buildup of fluid in a baby's skull can lead to pressure on the brain and potential brain damage. Fluid on the brain is relatively common, as 1 out of every 1,000 babies is born with the condition. It is typically the result of a birth defect, genetics, or an infection the mother had during pregnancy. Even with today's advances in modern medicine, the condition cannot be reversed, only treated, and can sometimes become lethal. Possible side effects of this condition include erectile dysfunction and bedwetting, both of which Andre would experience at different eras of his life. Though in poor health, young Chikatilo was a smart kid who loved to read. He used reading as a mental escape from the harsh real-life conditions of life in the village of Yablochnoi. The Chikatilo family lived in extreme squalor in a small hut, with Andre sharing the single bed with his mother and father, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory style. This problem was made worse by the fact that Chikatilo was a chronic bedwetter. Every time the boy would empty the contents of his bladder onto the threadbare sheets, he would be beaten without mercy by a stern mother. The family would survive by eating leaves and grass during the Holodomor. Andre had an older brother, but according to a traumatizing story he was told by his mother, his at-the-time 5-year-old brother Stepan was kidnapped, murdered, and cannibalized by the next-door neighbors, though there is no evidence supporting the documented existence of a sibling. Both the brother and the story of his unfortunate and grisly demise might have been a fabrication created by Chikatilo's mother to keep the boy from straying too far during the famine. During World War II, when Andre was 4 years old, his father Roman Chikatilo was drafted to fight for the USSR and sent off to war, where he was taken prisoner by the Nazis. The absence of Roman devastated young Andre, who was closer to his dad than he was to his mother. While his father was a prisoner of war, His mother Anna was raped and impregnated by Nazi soldiers during their occupation of the Ukraine known as the Reichskommissariat Ukraine. This assault was carried out as a 7-year-old Chikatilo watched in horror and perverse confusion. The rape resulted in his mother Anna becoming pregnant with and giving birth to his sister Tatiana. In school, young Andrei was awkward, overly sensitive, and prone to being bullied by his classmates due to his awful nearsightedness, homemade clothes, and chubby breasts. To try to fit in, he overcompensated for his physical shortcomings by studying hard and becoming chairman of the school's communist committee and editor of the school newspaper. At the age of 17, like documented in so many other serial killers, Chikatilo had a serious head injury. While working out on the farm, Andrei tripped over the metal rods of a horse-drawn rake and smashed his head onto the road, receiving a serious concussion. When Chikatilo's father, Roman, returned from the war disabled and suffering from tuberculosis, Andrei viewed his father's capture and survival as shameful, having been indoctrinated with the Soviet cause from an early age. His adolescence was full of war and chaos, as the Nazis' blitzkrieg attacks destroyed parts of the village almost daily, including the Chikatilo family hut burning down on one occasion. Having witnessed the savage rape of his mother and the after effects of his father's war injuries and time in the Kriegsgefangene Lager after capture, Chikatilo developed a hatred for the Germans and dug his heels in further on his Soviet beliefs. When Stalin died, a 17-year-old Andrei was even said to have bawled his eyes out like a little baby. He remained faithful to the Communist Party until his arrest, when he was unceremoniously kicked out. His devotion was so deep that later in life, he would become obsessed with books that chronicled the torture that German prisoners experienced at the hands of their Russian captors. The bedwetting and his inability to get an erection continued throughout Chikatilo's teens. He was an awkward kid who couldn't talk to girls. Besides, there was nothing young Andrei could do to get his flaccid dick hard, and he considered it a sign of weakness. He wouldn't find out what worked for him sexually until he was an adult, legally anyway, at the age of 18 years old. In the spring of 1954, Andrei's younger sister Tatiana's 13-year-old friend came calling at the Chikatilo house looking for a friend. Though his sister wasn't home, Chikatilo welcomed her in and shut the door. He then pounced on the girl and wrestled her to the floor, finally turgid in the brief heat of the battle. However, before Andrei could do anything further, he ejaculated in his pants and released his grip on the girl. She was able to run away, leaving Chikatilo alone and ashamed about his predicament. Dwelling on the incident, he resolved that he would get a hold of himself and control his sexual desires. To Chikatilo, in his own words, a cunt is the organ of human reproduction, and he would swear never to touch anyone's but his wife's. Besides, it wasn't the sex act that excited him. It was the power and the fear, and the concepts of sexual release and violence became intertwined forever in the mind of Andrei Chikatilo. Graduating from high school in 1954, Chikatilo submitted his application to Moscow State University, and although he received high marks from his teachers, his request was denied. Andrei had passed all the pre-admission criteria, but was turned down by the university due to his father's war record, something that Andrei had always been ashamed of. Rejected by the only school he had ever wanted to attend, Chikatilo opted for vocational school rather than applying to other universities, and began his training as a telephone and communications repairman. It was around this time that Chikatilo had his first real relationship at the age of 19. After multiple attempts at sexual intercourse had failed due to Chikatilo never being able to get an erection, his new lover gossiped about his little problem, and the rumors spread to his acquaintances. In 1950s USSR, there was no treatment for sexual impotence, and if there were something available, it probably would have been illegal under the strict Soviet law. He began to think that the whole town was talking about him behind his back, and the relationship didn't last long. Andrei believed his impotence to be due to his mental state. However, it had more to do with his birth defects, specifically hydrocephaly, as he was capable of ejaculating but not maintaining an erection. During his often unsuccessful attempts at masturbation, Chikatilo would tug on his flaccid penis so often and with such ferocity that it often would become bruised and swollen. At the age of 21, Chikatilo was called upon by his country for service like his father before him. It has been reported that during his service, Chikatilo was raped by another soldier. This is something I couldn't find concrete evidence about, but during the craziness of the time, it doesn't seem illogical. It could possibly explain why things got even darker after Andrei's stint in the military. From an early age, Chikatilo's damaged brain connected both sex and violence as one. That is probably why later in life, he could only get it hard through violence and rape. You see, rape isn't about sex to a rapist. Instead, it's about power and control. By experiencing the pain and despair of his own rape, the future rapist would channel that suffering from within himself and take his victims in an effort to be the one on top of the situation and to wallow in the agony of others. His service didn't just teach the young man about pain and suffering. It also trained him to be callous and unfeeling about death and the act of killing. Despite his natural predilection for violence, as a soldier, Chikatilo didn't have a single confirmed kill in combat during his 3 years of service. When he was done with the military, he headed back to his native village to live with his parents. His depression and shame were so severe that he even tried to commit suicide via hanging himself. Unfortunately, he wasn't successful. Eventually, the paranoia became too much for Chikatilo, and he moved out of the area. Chikatilo described the incident in a 1993 interview as follows. "Girls were going behind my back, whispering that I was impotent. I was so ashamed. I tried to hang myself. My mother and some young neighbors pulled me out of the noose. I thought no one would want such a shamed man, so I had to run away from there, away from my homeland." Rejected by both his peers and members of the opposite sex, Chikatilo packed up stakes and headed to Russia with hatred in his heart, moving to a town that would become his future hunting grounds, Rostov-on-Don, where he would come to be known as the Rostov Ripper. Upon moving to Rostov, Chikatilo worked as a communications engineer and rented a small shitty apartment close to his work. There he developed elaborate revenge fantasies in which he would capture his chatty former lover and tear her apart. It wasn't long before a little bit of his hometown came to him in the form of his younger sister Tatiana, who moved in with Andrei after she finished up her schooling. After a couple weeks of living with her awkward and lonely older brother, she started to feel sorry for him and vowed to find him a bride before the age of 30. Soon after, Tatiana introduced him to her friend, Feodosia Fenya Odnacheva. Fenya was a 24-year-old daughter of a coal miner who happened to be a virgin, just like Andrei had wanted. When the two first tried to consummate the marriage and failed, the loving Fenya was quick to accept her husband despite his inability to get it up. The Chikatilo's sex life consisted of Andrei trying to shove inanimate objects into her vagina as she slept, and occasionally masturbating outside of her and then thrusting his semen-covered fingers deep within her in an effort to procreate. Astonishingly, Chikatilo was able to father two children with Fenya despite his impotence. In 1965, Fenya gave birth to the couple's first child, a girl, Ludmilla. 4 years later, they were blessed with a son, Yuri. Fenya remained married to Chikatilo all the way up until his capture. While working as a communications engineer in the mid-60s, Chikatilo was also going to school and eventually obtained degrees in Russian literature, engineering, and Marxism-Leninism from the Rostov University in 1970. After getting his credentials, Andrei was appointed as the chairman of the Regional Committee for Physical Education and Sports, with full approval of the Communist Party, which he was a member of. This position was basically a glorified Soviet PE teacher. The USSR even gave Chikatilo a motorcycle which he would ride around the region going from school gym to school gym for his lessons. His career as an administrator was an abysmal failure because he lacked the respect of the other teachers. As a teacher, he failed as well because he couldn't discipline the students. His pupils nicknamed him the Goose because of his long neck and protruding Adam's apple and would tease and harass the strange, awkward instructor. A bully can always identify their victim, and many of the children in the classes could see the victim dwelling within their weird teacher. Most of the killers we talk about here on True Crime Horror Story are quite active once they begin their murderous careers. I bet if we did an average age of our killers, it would land somewhere in the mid-20s. While Chikatilo had his first outburst of depravity back in 1954, it wouldn't be until almost 20 years later that he would strike again at the age of 36. While supervising a boy's dormitory, Chikatilo pulled down the pants of a sleeping young boy and began to fellate him. The pedophile pedagogue was caught by a group of seniors who kicked the shit out of him. After the beating at the hands of his students, Chikatilo began to carry a knife with him to class, which he would casually run his fingers up and down in his pocket when they weren't in the other one playing with something else. The beating had been enough to keep the Goose's busy hands from trying to cop a feel on anything but his own limp member. That was until 5 years later, when he asked a 15-year-old female student to stay after class for a remedial session. A short side note, listeners. I've made the choice, though it is available, not to mention the name of the teenage victim in this incident, and will continue to do so for any underage survivors of the horrible cases we cover here on True Crime Horror Story. We will, however, mention the names of the dead, as they deserve to have their story told. For surviving victims, however, I would imagine they would not want their names to be tied to these monsters in any way, shape, or form. With the girl all alone, Andre was overcome with the desire to fondle her breasts and vagina. As he pinned his pupil to his desk, once again Chikatilo came in his pants, and the girl was able to get away. This would be the first time his actions were reported to the Soviet. Instead of, I don't know, calling the police and locking up this twisted pervert, then performing an investigation to see if this was not an isolated incident, the school authorities just asked Chikatilo to resign from his post. Maybe if the goose had been dealt with properly then and there, all the horrible shit we're about to talk about may have never happened. In September of 78, Chikatilo found a new job, again teaching children at a Soviet school, despite his previous transgressions. After his dismissal, rumors had started to circulate, and Andre's wife Fenya took a job at the school as well to keep tabs on the goose. Feeling the heat coming from his wife, Chikatilo purchased a small hut in Shakhty at 26 Mezhevoy Lane. The small village of Shakhty was destitute, the kind of place where the fences were fashioned together from rusted pipes, rotting wood, or old mattresses. The roads were so small and poorly maintained that it was difficult to even get a car to the residence. Just 3 days before Christmas of 1978, Chikatilo would take his first victim. He had been grooming 9-year-old Lenochka Elena Zatkotnova for quite some time, offering the girl chewing gum at the bus stop they both frequented. But on that particular day when Andre caught a glimpse of the second grader in her hooded coat, winter hat, and boots, innocently carrying her school bag, the goose knew he had to have her. Elena would often go ice skating with friends after school. On that day, she happily announced to her group of friends that she had to go because a nice old man was going to give her some imported chewing gum. She would be back shortly, however, and share the treat with her pals. She never returned. Elena met up with the nice old man at about 6 p.m., and the two headed to his ramshackle hut in Shakhty. Once they entered the home, the face of the old man changed into something that wasn't so nice anymore. A predatory grin was now carved into the face that was once so warm and kind. Chikatilo threw the girl to the floor and began to rip off all her clothes. She kicked and screamed until the goose choked her unconscious and wrapped his scarf around her head. He then attempted to rape her, but he wasn't able to get hard once again. In frustration, he shoved his dirty fingers into her in an act of sexual desperation. As the blood began to flow from the poor girl's vagina, Chikatilo became more sexually excited than he had ever been. As Yelena began to awaken and squirm in pain, the man she once described as sweet plunged a knife into her stomach 3 times. The moment that the blade entered the young girl's flesh was so intense that Chikatilo spontaneously ejaculated. It was then that the amalgamation of sex and violence evolved in Andre's mind into sex and slashing, stabbing, or even ripping. After Chikatilo had spent his seed, he wrapped up Yelena's body in clothes and tossed her into the Grishevka River. According to Andre, the girl was still alive, though barely, as her body hit the icy water and sank into its murky depths. The body of Yelena Zatkonova was found 2 days later. There was plenty of evidence linking Chikatilo to the crime. Her blood was all over the doorstep and front stoop of his hut, and the light had been left on all night. Multiple witnesses told investigators that the awkward man had been bringing kids back to his private shithole for quite some time. When police called Chikatilo in for questioning, he used his wife Fenya as an alibi, claiming he was home the entire night, and for some reason, she backed his story. Whether it was out of loyalty, confusion, or the fear that maybe she could be the next one under the knife, she stood by her husband. Despite the evidence against him, including friends of little Yelena, describing her sweet old bearer of chewing gum as a middle-aged man with thick glasses, the police pursued another man, Alexander Kravchenko, instead. Even though Kravchenko was neither middle-aged nor aware of eyeglasses, Kravchenko had been previously arrested and sent to prison for the rape and murder of a 17-year-old girl. Why he was walking the streets, your guess is as good as mine, but unfortunately, it's a story we repeat far too often here on the show. While Kravchenko was being interrogated by authorities, a composite sketch was created and distributed that was shockingly similar in appearance to Andrei Chikatilo. The principal of one of the schools that Chikatilo had taught at came forward, pointing the finger at his former colleague. Rather than listen to reason when confronted with their terrible mistake, the police told the principal not to discuss the case with anyone else and doubled down on Kravchenko. Through questionable means, aka torture, investigators were able to get a confession out of Alexander. Using a bloodstain on Kravchenko's wife's jumper that matched Elena's blood type as evidence, and by coercing Kravchenko's wife and neighbors out of testifying that he was home at the time of the attack, although he was, the court convicted Kravchenko of the murder of Yelena Zatkanova and sentenced him to death. The sentence was carried out by firing squad in 1983. In March of 1981, Chikatilo was laid off from his position due to budget cuts and took a job as a supply delivery man for an industrial company in Rostov. Due to the distance of the factory from his home, Andrei would often take the bus or the train to work. It was at these terminals that he found many of his unfortunate victims. Chikatilo purposely took jobs that required him to travel in order to feed his sick impulses. Having come dangerously close to being apprehended after the killing of little Yelena Zatkanova, Chikatilo laid low for a while, but he could never quell his dark desires. His next victim would come in the fall of 81, in the form of 16-year-old Larissa Tachenko, who was waiting for a bus near the Rostov Public Library when she happened upon the goose. Larissa was a troubled girl who spent her time in and out of boarding school. She frequently dated young Soviet soldiers who would offer her food, drink, and other favors in exchange for sex. Chikatilo asked the girl to accompany him to a wooded area. While Tachenko may have expected this recreational escapade to end in a sexual tryst, she had no idea what she was signing up for when she followed the odd man down the tree-lined path and into the darkness. As the two came to a clearing, Chikatilo pounced on the girl and began to furiously rip away her clothes. The assailant pinned her to the ground but again was unable to achieve an erection, so out of frustration, he repeatedly punched the girl in the head and then shoved dirt into her open mouth until she stopped screaming. Chikatilo retrieved a nearby 6-foot-long jagged stick and began to penetrate his victim with it vaginally and then anally. He then strangled the girl before mutilating the corpse. Having forgotten his trusty knife, as this killing had been a little bit more spur of the moment than the last, Andrei used his teeth to remove and consume the dead girl's nipples. He then buried his face deep between her legs and ravenously chewed apart her vagina while spontaneously ejaculating from the intensity of the experience. As Chikatilo lay next to the corpse of his teenage victim, he began to feel what he described as utter ecstasy. When he could muster the strength to stand up, Andrei then frolicked around the body, delirious with the experience. When the emotion subsided, he covered Larissa's body with fallen tree branches and buried her clothes. Andrei would be sure to never leave his trusty knife behind again. The killing of Larissa Tachenko resonated with Chikatilo like nothing he had ever experienced before. It was at that moment that Andrei Chikatilo no longer felt he was the goose. He had found his true calling in life. He was no longer a disgraced teacher. He was the Ripper. The Rostov Ripper. Though Chikatilo knew he was destined to be a serial killer, he was still careful after his second victim, having had one brush with the law, and he waited to strike again. On June 12, 1982, 13-year-old Lyubov Lyuba Biryak was carrying shopping bags on her way home to the village of Donskoy. She strolled along the side of the road in her best white floral dress and sandals. After all, it was a gorgeous summer day for Russian standards. The beauty of the day was cut short, however, via Chikatilo's new double-sided folding knife. It is unclear whether it was by manipulation or by force, but Andrei took the girl into the bushes near the road. He then stabbed her over 40 times, including shoving the blade deep into both of her eye sockets, and then he raped the corpse. Her body wasn't found for weeks, and by the time it was discovered, it had deteriorated to skeletal remains in the summer heat. After his third victim, Andrei Chikatilo went into full-on berserker mode. There would be no more of this waiting and being careful for the Rostov Ripper. From 1982 to 1990, he would claim over 50 victims. Chikatilo didn't discriminate when it came to his victims, sexually assaulting and killing both girls and boys. While he preferred the blood of children, his victims ranged from age 7 to the early 40s. While the Rostov Rippers' reign of terror was upon Russia, rumors circulated about the killings being the work of a group of cannibals, gang members, satanic cults, werewolves, black market organ harvesters, and even a group of killers who drove around in a luxury sedan belonging to party officials with the license plate DSC, or Death to Soviet Children. Chikatilo probably wouldn't have got away with his vile acts for so long if it wasn't for the fact that the Soviet media swept his crimes under the rug and tried to make sure they were not heavily publicized while he was still on the loose. After all, having a serial killer in their midst was unbecoming of the communist state. Eventually, the problem became too much to ignore, and the Moscow militia sent Major Mikhail Fedosov and his team, headed by a renowned forensic specialist, Viktor Burakov, to Rostov, to take over the investigation into the Ripper. Almost immediately after his arrival, Fedosov sent a report to his superiors, criticizing the ineptitude of the local police department and suggesting that all these murders were the work of a single sex-crazed maniac. Moscow was reluctant to accept Fedosov's findings, as they believed that serial killers were only a product of the Western world and not possible in Russia. Instead of scouring the streets in search of the Rostov Ripper, they instead focused on incarcerated sex offenders and mental patients, and by the end of 1983, they had a half dozen potential rippers ready to confess. All this did was benefit the real Rostov Ripper, Andrei Chikatilo, who continued to kill with impunity. In addition to the crooked media and Soviet state enabling Chikatilo to carry out his crimes, forensic technology in the 1980s was not as advanced as it is today. Samples of semen taken from the victims indicated that the Rostov Ripper had an AB blood type. However, Chikatilo was a non-secretor, a term that describes individuals whose semen and blood test as different blood types. Andrei was again interviewed about the murders, but subsequently released after his blood type didn't match that of the semen found on any of the corpses. Chikatilo would go on to kill again and again, and in February of 1984, he would take the life of his oldest victim, Marta Ryabenko, and yet another man would be executed for a crime he didn't commit. The police interviewed and arrested a mentally challenged man who happened to be in the area at the time and coerced him into confessing to at least two of the murders. He later withdrew his confession, claiming he was given under duress, but his pleas fell on deaf ears, and he was executed by firing squad. Later that year, Chikatilo would happen upon a former mistress of his, named Tatiana, and offered to take her and her 11-year-old daughter Svetlana on a lovely spring picnic. As the two consumed alcohol and the girl played in the grass, Tatiana began to mock Andrei about his erectile dysfunction, as they had been lovers in the past. What Tatiana didn't know is that she was no longer dining with the goose, but instead, she was setting the table for the Rostov Ripper, and herself and little Svetlana would be the main course. Chikatilo removed a hammer from his bag and bashed Tatiana's brains all over the blanket the two had been sharing. He then ran after her screaming daughter and also hit her with the hammer before stabbing her to death and decapitating her body. He then sat down to enjoy the remainder of the afternoon meal, with the mutilated corpses of both the mother and daughter keeping him company. The Rostov Ripper continued to claim victim after victim, as the police twiddled their thumbs gazing at pictures of Stalin instead of doing their jobs. As spring gave way to summer, 19-year-old Anna Lemesheva disappeared on her way to a dental appointment. Chikatilo approached the girl and asked her if she would like to join him for a swim on that hot summer day. When she refused, he pulled out a carpenter's knife and stabbed her to death. Similar to his first victim, he then removed the young woman's nipples and swallowed them. He then disemboweled her corpse, removing her uterus and chewing on it for a while before throwing it into the bushes. That September, Chikatilo was arrested by police after learning of his shakti hut and the sheer volume of children he had been molesting there. In his briefcase, they found a dirty towel, a length of rope, a jar of Vaseline, and a fake police ID. Unable to keep him for more than 72 hours without formally charging him with a crime, the police first charged him with harassment. Then upon further investigation, they uncovered the molestation incidents from his teaching career. Though all the evidence pointed to Chikatilo as the Rostov Ripper, and they were sure they had their guy, they were unable to try him for murder due to the blood type evidence and his non-secretor status. Andrei was released from prison after serving just a meager 3 months of his one-year sentence. He was then kicked out of the Communist Party, something that broke his Bolshevik heart. Free from prison, Chikatilo continued his murderous career throughout 1985 until 1986, when interestingly, he took the entire year off and went on vacation for his 50th birthday. The heat had intensified as police were regularly patrolling both bus and railway stations in search of the killer. Rather than continue his path of violence, he lay low waiting for the killings of at this point at least 30 people to just blow over. Unable to control himself any longer, he slipped back out of the Goose and back into the Ripper in May of 1987. Chikatilo would take over 20 more victims in the span of 3 years, and his last murder would be committed on November 6, 1990. For an unknown reason, 22-year-old Svetlana Korostik accompanied Andre into the woods near Leskoz Station, where she was beaten, stabbed, and mutilated. Both her tongue and her nipples were cut off and consumed by Chikatilo at the scene of the crime. He then covered her body with leaves and slipped back out of the woods to Leskoz Station, but he didn't know that as he walked back from the woods, he was being watched. A police officer noticed what appeared to be a streak of blood across Chikatilo's cheek as he made his way over to a water well and washed the crimson off of his wrinkled face. The officer filed a report about the incident, and once again Andrei Chikatilo was a major suspect in the Rostov Ripper murder cases. As investigators thoroughly examined the evidence collected thus far, one name kept popping up time and time again throughout the years, Andrei Romanovich Chikatilo, aka The Goose. They began surveillance on Chikatilo and witnessed him approaching several young children at the railway station. A week after her murder, the body of Svetlana Korostik was found. Police moved in and arrested Chikatilo, who denied being involved in any of the murders. That was until November 29th, when the Rostov Ripper broke and confessed to his psychologist that it had been him all along killing all of those people right under their noses. Chikatilo broke down his crimes in grisly detail, telling police that he would lure his victims into the woods or to his hut in Shakti by enticing them with the promise of cigarettes, alcohol, pornographic videos, or money. He would then attack them, tie them up, and stab them dozens of times. Chikatilo was sexually aroused by their struggles and pleas, and especially the mutilation of their bodies. He told them how he would perform sex acts with his knife on his female victims, cut off their sex organs, bite off their nipples, gouge out their eyes, and stuff body parts into their own mouths. His male victims were treated completely differently, as he would use them to reenact his childhood fantasy of torturing a Nazi soldier, the opposite of what had been done to his own father after he was captured as a prisoner of war. He refused to explain why he had often removed their penises, though most likely it was because of his anger at his own inability to achieve a normal erection. Most of his victims had their eyes either stabbed into or completely removed, as Chikatilo believed that at the moment of their death, his picture would be forever burned into their retinas, linking him to the crime. This was sort of a common belief in Russia in the past, that the last image seen by the dead would remain in their eyes forever. On the day that the prosecutor was to give his final arguments at Chikatilo's trial, the murderer began to sing loudly and obnoxiously, and had to be removed from the courtroom. Sometime after his arrest, Andrei began to lose his mind. His behavior at the trial became increasingly bizarre. He would often pull his pants down and shout that he was not a homosexual, and sometimes claim to be pregnant and lactating. His demeanor switched from boredom to anger at the drop of a dime. In perhaps a moment of clarity, Chikatilo confessed to 56 murders. He was found guilty of 52 of those crimes, and was sentenced to death on October 14th of 1992. The Soviet Union collapsed in 1992, and Chikatilo was still around to hear about and experience the fall of his former communist dream. On Valentine's Day of 1994, Andrei Chikatilo was executed by a single gunshot to the back of the head. His last words were, "Don't blow my brains out. The Japanese want to buy them." His death was met with a resounding applause from the family members of the victims in attendance, as well as the prison staff and even the other prisoners. And with that single bullet, the most vile and despicable serial killer Russia had ever seen was exterminated, the Rostov Ripper, Andrei Chikatilo. Felt like ripping and touching everything. What I did was not for sexual pleasure, rather it brought me some peace of mind. Nipples? I like to nibble on them. They are so pink and springy. I I am a mistake of nature, a mad beast. Part 2. Der Metzger von Hanover. The late 1870s was a prosperous time for the German people. The German Empire had prevailed in the Franco-German War of 1870 and 1871, and in the Treaty of Frankfurt, demanded that the French government pay a whopping 5 billion francs to reimburse the Empire for their expenses during their occupation of France. The French and Germans had been having diplomatic disputes, though the issues were settled in France's favor. They still chose to declare war on the German Empire. Imagine trying to stick up for yourself and refusing to hand the school bully your lunch money, getting your ass kicked, then having to shell out not just your pocket change, but your life savings to the perpetrator after your defeat. Not a good situation for the French. The Germans were thriving, with the invention of both the first electric locomotive and the two-stroke gas engine in 1879. It was in that very same year that world-renowned theoretical physicist Albert Einstein was born. Einstein would go on to be one of the most influential scientific minds in history. It was under these circumstances that another famous German would be born as well, although he would come to be known for very different reasons. Friedrich Heinrich Karl Harman, better known as Fritz, was born on October 25, 1879 in Hanover, Germany, to wealthy yet violent and alcoholic parents, Ollie and Johanna Harman. His father carried on numerous affairs, even contracting syphilis from one of his mistresses, something that could be deadly at the time. Ollie couldn't be bothered with his children, other than to lay down the law with a stern brand of discipline. Fritz's mother would often dress him up in little girl's clothing. He was a quiet child, who preferred to stay inside and play with one of his five sisters' dolls, or to crochet, or help prepare supper, rather than go outside and play ball with the neighborhood boys. He was a poor student, who was bullied and ridiculed by his classmates due to his feminine nature. After being molested by a teacher, his academic achievements declined even further, and he was held back in school twice. From a young age, Fritz had a fascination with knives, often standing outside of the butcher's shop window watching the men go to work on the dismemberment of a hog or other unfortunate creature, with a twinkle in his eye. At the age of 16, with the encouragement of his parents, Fritz enrolled in the Neubreisach Military Academy. At first, he did well at the academy, but he would only last 6 months there before he became prone to fainting spells due to his extreme anxiety that was misdiagnosed as epilepsy. After being discharged in 1895 due to his medical condition, Harman returned to Hanover, where his first known sex crime occurred when he himself was still only 17 years old. He would lure little boys to abandoned houses and then take them down into the cellar and rape them. Police actually caught Fritz in the act during one of these subterranean transgressions, and he was committed to a mental institution. After being interviewed and studied by a team of psychologists, they deemed Harman to be incurably deranged and were prepared to lock him up and throw away the key. However, less than a year after his incarceration, Fritz escaped from the Hildesheim Asylum with the aid of his mother. Yes, the woman who would get hammered drunk and parade him around in fancy dresses actually aided her criminally insane son in breaking out of the clink and helped him go into hiding with relatives in Zurich, Switzerland. Switzerland was better than the insane asylum, but it wasn't home to Fritz. He loved his homeland, and he took the chance on returning to Hanover 16 months after he escaped the mental institution. Harman was engaged to a young woman named Erna Lowert, and soon she became pregnant with his first child. This was probably the most, what some would call, normal period of Fritz's strange life. In October of 1900, Harman was called upon by his country for the draft. Why they could find him for compulsory service, but not track him down for his escape from custody baffles me. Maybe in the German culture pre-World War I, military was far more valued than mental health. Soon after being drafted, Fritz was deployed to Alsace, France to serve as a rifleman. Harman was an excellent marksman and popular amongst his battalion. Later in life, Harman would describe this period as being the happiest he had ever known. He finally felt accepted. That feeling wouldn't last long because after suffering again from recurring fainting spells and dizziness, Fritz was hospitalized and eventually given a medical discharge. Even though his stint in the army was brief, Harman was allowed to collect a military pension for his service. Once again returning to his home of Hanover, Harmon started working in his father's cigar factory. Soon after he was hired, he tried to sue his father, but got his ass handed to him in court. After the suit was dropped, the two got into a violent confrontation in which Fritz threatened to kill his father. Ollie tried to have his son committed once again, but was unsuccessful as the psychologist deemed that Fritz was not crazy, he just lacked the moral compass that most people were born with and didn't care about what was right or wrong. Eventually, the father was able to forgive his son and once again take him under his wing, helping Fritz and his soon-to-be wife start a fish market business. Soon Harmon began to suspect that his pregnant fiancée Erna was having an affair. When he confronted her, she told him to get the fuck out and never come back. And since the fish market was solely in her name due to his former fugitive status, that is what he was forced to do. This is when Harmon began to descend to the criminal underworld, scraping by as a petty thief, con artist, and grave robber. He was in and out of jail until his first major sentence for fraud landed him in prison just as World War I was beginning. When Fritz was released from prison, he became a police informant, something that he used to deflect the attention for his crimes away from himself and onto others. While Fritz may not have been the sharpest knife in the drawer, he was extremely manipulative and cunning, and able to hide his status as an informant from his criminal peers. It was around this time that Harmon began to experiment with homosexuality, specifically his proclivity for young boys. Without restrictions and a fiancé to check in with, Harmon began to give in to his carnal hunger, and the Butcher of Hanover would take his first victim in autumn of 1918. After the Treaty of Versailles, in the late 1910s, Germany wasn't in the great economic state into which Fritz was born. There was a major shortage of food, specifically meat, and some of the poorer residents were starving. Harmon would use this to his advantage, often luring young boys to his apartment with the promise of a meal before attacking. His first victim, Friedel Roth, was a 17-year-old transient living in the ghost quarter of Hanover, the roughest spot of the city, and an area that was rumored by locals to be haunted. He had run away from home after pawning all of his soldier father's civilian clothes for cash. Roth was promised work and food by Harmon, and even told a friend about the nice man who he had befriended in the slums of Hanover. On the night of his death, witnesses said they had seen Roth sauntering nonchalantly about the foggy alleys of the ghost quarter, as if he had not a care in the world. Harmon lured the young man back to his apartment in the Red Row that he shared with his new lover, gigolo and entertainer, Hans Granz, a man 20 years his senior, who worshipped Fritz more as a master than a lover. The apartment was backed up to the Lean River, which the public often used as a trash receptacle rather than a swimming or fishing area. Once back to the security of his apartment, Harmon would pounce onto his victims and attempt to bite deep into their throats and remove their Adam's apples. He described this attack as his love bite. He would then use a knife to sever Friedel's carotid artery and trachea, killing him almost instantly. After Roth was dead, with the assistance of his lover Hans, Harmon stripped the bones of his victims and butchered their carcasses into various pseudo-cuts of meat, which he would then sell to the public in the black market to capitalize on the meat shortage for financial gain. Those patrons of the Butcher of Hanover believed the meat they were getting on the cheap to be smuggled pork and not that of a slaughtered runaway. Harmon was even questioned by police about the missing Friedel, stating, "A missing 17-year-old boy? A pity, but I didn't happen to see him." The true number of his victims is unknown, but from 1919 to 1922, as many as 100 young men went missing in the Hanover area, mostly runaways and sex workers. In one particular month of 1923, three young men went missing from the Hanover bus station, Friedel Roth, a boy named Fritz Frankie, and another boy named Wilhelm Schultz. The disappearances were easily connected by investigators. Still an informant at the time, and known to distribute the victim's possessions on the black market, Harmon was interviewed by police and agreed to help them find the killer. Again, using his position as a police informant to cover the tracks of his heinous acts. The heat turned up in May of 1924, when some kids found a skull on the bank of the Lean River. Authorities ordered that the entire river be thoroughly searched, and additional human remains were uncovered near the revolting couple's apartment. 1 week later, another skull was found. It wasn't until June that a man rowing a boat down the Lean found a gunny sack full of human ribs and shin bones. Due to the location of the remains, suspicion soon pointed towards Harmon. He had been a known homosexual, child molester, and criminal in the area, and had been confirmed to have sold the property of the dead. Just like Chikatilo, police dispatched a special investigator who began surveillance on the butcher, following him to Hanover Central Station, where he was screaming at a 15-year-old boy. When police approached, the entire demeanor of Fritz changed as if a switch was flipped. He went from angry to cordial and helpful, demanding that the boy be arrested for being in the country illegally. When separated from his captor, the teenager chronicled the 4-day ordeal he had suffered at the hands of Harmon, which included rape and constant death threats. The officer returned to Harmon, whose demeanor had again changed, this time to that of a caged animal struggling to break free. "You are wanted at headquarters, Fritz. By the way, where'd you get that keychain you're wearing? It resembles one owned by Heinrich Struss, a young student who disappeared here last August. You are under arrest for murder." Harmon would not go quietly into the night and prowled with the officer up and down the train tracks until help arrived and he was taken into custody. The police then went to Fritz's apartment at number 2 Rote Rihe and arrested his accomplice, Hans Granz, who was taken into custody without incident. Granz happened to be wearing pants identified as belonging to one of the missing young men. Authorities conducted a thorough search of the apartment and discovered that almost every surface had been stained with blood. Numerous possessions tied to the victims were also found at the residence, soon after dubbed the Werewolf Den by the media. The amount of evidence against the butcher and his boy was overwhelming. At first, Fritz denied having anything to do with the crimes, proclaiming the evidence against him to be purely circumstantial. That was until he heard about Hans Granz throwing him under the bus for the murders and saying all Hans did was hold the boys down and help dispose of the bones of Harmon's victims. With this betrayal, and at the urging of his family, Fritz Harmon confessed to the rape and murder of between 50 and 70 young men, the exact number he could not confirm. He denied ever intending to kill any of his victims, but instead claimed he was overcome with a rabid sexual passion and the irresistible urge to tear out the throats of the young men. Neighbors and acquaintances testified as to receiving strange meats and sausages from Harmon for an extremely low price, though sometimes after ingesting the peculiar protein, they would become ill. After his capture, the media would dub Fritz Harmon the Vampire of Hanover, the Werewolf of Hanover, and what I believe would have been his personal favorite, given his childhood predilections, the Butcher of Hanover. While the true extent of his crimes will never be known, it is believed that Harmon killed at least 40 during his murderous career. A mass grave and memorial in honor of the victims of the Butcher of Hanover was erected in the Stockener Cemetery and still stands today. The trial of Fritz Harmon lasted less than 2 weeks, with almost 200 witnesses called to the stand to testify about the macabre deeds of the monster lurking in their own backyard. On December 19th, 1924, Harmon was found guilty of 24 of the 27 murders he was charged with and sentenced to death. He didn't dispute the verdict of his trial, simply stating, "I go to the decapitating block joyfully and happily. Don't send me to the insane asylum. I would rather not live. Were I set at liberty, I would murder again. Why I kill is a mystery to me." On the morning of April 15th, 1925, the Butcher of Hanover, Fritz Harmon, was led to the guillotine. His final words were, "I am guilty, gentlemen, but hard though it may be, I want to die as a man. I repent, but I do not fear death." His head was then placed in the stocks and the blade released, decapitating the butcher and ending his life. "I never intended to hurt those youngsters, but I knew that if I got going, something would happen, and that made me cry. I would throw myself on top of those boys and bite through their Adam's apple, throttling them at the same time. I'd make 2 cuts in the abdomen and put the intestines in a bucket, then soak up all the blood and crush the bones until the shoulders broke. Now I could get the heart, lungs, and kidneys and chop them up and put them in my bucket. I'd take the flesh off the bones and put it in my wax cloth bag. It would take me 5 or 6 trips to take everything and throw it down the toilet or into the river. I always hated doing this, but I couldn't help it. My passion was so much stronger than the horror of the cutting and the chopping." Thanks for joining us for another episode of True Crime Horror Story. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Suggested movies similar to today's cases: For the Rostov Ripper, Citizen X, a 1995 true crime TV movie about Chikatilo, directed by Chris Girolamo, based on the book by Robert Cullen, and Evilinko, a 2004 true crime movie written and directed by David Grieco and starring the legendary Malcolm McDowell as Andre Chikatilo. And For the Butcher of Hanover, The Tenderness of Wolves, a 1973 true crime horror movie directed by Uli Lommel, and Sleepaway Camp, a 1983 slasher directed by Robert Hiltzik. If you like what you hear here on True Crime Horror Story, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You can also think about joining our Patreon at www.patreon.com/truecrimehs, and then stay tuned after this show on Patreon for the True Crime Horror Story After Show with Dom and JD, as well as early access to ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content available only on Patreon. This episode features research by Lana McCall, music by Mechanical Ghost, Silverman Sound Studios, Dar Golan, FMNC, and LFM, and artwork by Nuclear Heat Graphics. Sources for this episode's cases are available in the credits section of our website. Has violent crime impacted you or someone close to you? Send us your story at truecrimehorrorstory@gmail.com. True Crime Horror Story. Sometimes truth is more brutal than fiction.
Hi, everybody. This is Homestyle Mike from Podcast 1289. Due to cutbacks in healthcare programs, we came together to create an herbal supplement we like to call P1289. To bring you supplement P1289, we force our loved ones to listen to hours and hours of ghost stories, cryptid sightings, conspiracies, and all other forms of flimflam via Ludovico technique, and collect the tears of their disappointment to give you the pure essence of P1289. Our users have given testimony regarding the absolute clarity of mind they receive while taking P1289.
You think Jason Voorhees still has a dick?
Nah, the fish took it.
P1289 is also a natural aphrodisiac, giving you the confidence to become a sexual dynamo.
Hello, I am a human. Donate your flesh to construct my megabody.
For all you holistic fucktwats, P1289 also comes in healing crystals purified in a glowing irradiated pond out in Nevada.
Hey, Mike.
Oh, hey, Rob.
P1289 also comes in viewable ASMR video format to heal you of all your anxieties, chronic depression, and spontaneous drug-induced psychotic episodes.
There has to be a Disney princess now that is a total conspiracy nut.
I imagine her sitting at home with her 1,000 cats, mostly dead, and just a bag of fucking turds that she uses because she won't use the toilet.
Oh my god, you saw that episode of Hoarders 2?
I pulled out my teeth because I feel like there's a bug in the
Resident Nixon, we're gonna have to get those teeth back in your mouth.
Don't you come near my teeth, or I'll hit you with my jowls.
That's right. So who needs any of that liberal bullshit like quality medical care when you can heal what ails you the punk rock way?
Heroin.
No, Rob. By listening to Podcast 1289.
That makes a lot more sense, actually, yeah.
Warning. Side effects of P1289 may or may not include lockjaw, hearing loss, tongue, hair, severe stinky leg, total discoloration, hallucinations, leprosy, sudden and rapid hair growth, vomiting up teeth, not yours, vomiting up teeth, definitely yours, sweating blood and horrible taste in film, also gaping abdominal wounds that double as VCRs. So head on down to your local podcast dispensary, such as Spotify and iTunes, and get your prescription and holes filled with Podcast 1289. Now you know why our parents won't return our calls.